You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Questions are all around us.
Learn.
Why is liquid cold?
Learn.
What is maths?
Learn.
Why does this, hurt?
Learn.
What is the Enlightenment?
I don't know.
And now, thanks to the University of Auckland, it's time to ready, steady, learn.
It is indeed. And this morning we're speaking to doctoral candidate Kelsey Miller, who's a research fellow in marine science at the University of Auckland. Kia ora, Kelsey. How are you this morning?
Morena, Rachel. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's lovely to have you here. We're talking about kina barons today and some of the research you've been doing into that. Just to start us off, what are we talking about when we say kina barons? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's not really an easy answer. There is no formal definition. So kina barons are areas of our rocky reefs where kina, the common sea urchin, have grazed away all of the kelp, leaving behind these underwater deserts. So characterized by having no kelp or macroalgae and high densities of these kina.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, kina is one of those things that's, a really important part of our ecosystem here. It is something that is a delicacy. It's got really important cultural significance. But obviously, like anything, if there's an imbalance, it's not necessarily good for the environment. So what specifically is your research looking into around the behavior and the, outcome of these kina barons?
Well, firstly, I really want to thank you for making that point. While kina barons are a problem, kina themselves are not. We do really need them in low densities, and they are important for so many different things. So my work is understanding how can we reverse kina barons, so turn these areas back into healthy kelp forests. So the benefits of that would be having the kelp, which provides lots of ecosystem services, highly productive, is home and food to a lot of different species, and it can improve, the kina themselves will have their food again, so we'll be healthier. So my research is, what does kina removal do? Does it lead to a healthy ecosystem? And what is the practicality of doing it on large scales?
And so how did we get here in the first place? How is it that we've got too many kina? And, what sort of exacerbated this problem to begin with?
So if we look at it in a global context, this is a global problem. And kina barons with different species are formed in many places where there are kelp forests. And in almost every case, overfishing is one of the primary causes. So in New Zealand, large snapper and large crayfish love to eat kina. And when their population is too low, and particularly of those larger individuals that can eat big kina, then it gives an opportunity for those populations of kina to increase. And once there's too many, they can just overwhelm a kelp forest.
Right. So it's kind of, you knock one thing out of alignment in the food chain and then it all goes out of alignment, really.
Exactly. And once it happens, it's actually quite difficult to reverse. So it can take a large number of kina to turn a kelp forest into a barren. But once that's already established, only having one kina per square meter, so quite a low density, can graze any new kelp that tries to grow back. So you really have to reset the system.
Mm. And what ways do you sort of employ to reset the system, so to speak? What's been effective or sort of proving to be effective at the moment?
So the simplest is actually protection of the predators. So we know from work around the Lee Marine Lab and at the Good Island Marine Reserve at Tapu Nui Marine Reserves, as well as marine reserves in other parts of the world, that if we let nature do its thing, those populations can recover, graze down the kina populations, and that will allow kelp to come back on its own without any other work from us. But that can take decades to happen, so 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are interested in how can we speed up this process. and or can we do this in a more active way when we don't want to protect an area? So the two main ways that it can work are either killing the sea urchins, or if the quality is good enough, harvesting mm-hmm. the sea urchins.
And so the quality is not necessarily good, is that right? Because there's not that much for them to be eating in these spaces anyway.
Exactly. So that's a big part of the challenge is, while kina are a really important food source, when they don't have food to eat, the quality of their roe is not good as well. So in general, it's kina within kelp forests, you know, have as much food as they want, and they've got this nice, juicy, yellow roe. But when they don't have that food, the roe is quite small. Mm. Sometimes it's a poor color and doesn't taste as good.
It's an interesting thing to see how that problem kind of shakes all the way down the line, eh? What's next for your research specifically? What's the next stage for you?
Yeah, so the upcoming steps is I'm trying to create a guidebook. So community groups, hapu, people who are interested in restoring kelp forests on small scales will be able to have better information on understanding what kind of removal can and cannot do. And if they do choose to use it, understanding what methods they can use and how to do it to be most successful. And then we're also looking at understanding what creates fine scale variation in recovery. So if you remove kina from a huge area, kelp comes back, but it will come back better in some places than others.
Hmm. It's going to be an interesting one to follow. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really important research that's happening. Kelsey Miller, thank you for speaking with us. Have a great rest of your Tuesday.
Thank you. You as well.
Kia ora.
That was Ready, Steady, Learn, thanks to the University of Auckland, the best university.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.